When I went to teach in the prep school at age 19 for the first time, I asked the headmaster for some rules for teaching. He said, "Oh, I don't know." He said, "If you want to feel like kicking the boys, don't kick them with the point of your toe, but with the side of the foot." Well, I thought this was inadequate training for a professional life. Later on, I watched him teach, and then I could see that he was really a vital teacher, teaching Latin.
It wasn't Latin that Lionel Billows taught, except as a party piece. I met him in April 1964 on the battlefield of Omdurman, well, up the road. It was 110 in the shade, and the desert outside the windows of the Sudanese Teacher Training Institute shimmered like a David Lean long shot. On the platform, a man who looked across between Colonel Blimp and Gunter Grass, addressing 100 or so young teachers, including me. He was 55 then, teacher, maverick, joker, poet, and hero of the Madras Snowball, which trained 36,000 Indian primary school teachers in 3 years how to teach English, and a lot of other things. He taught for the British Council in Germany, Estonia, Cyprus, Egypt, Turkey, Lebanon, Switzerland, Uganda, Poland, and his book, The Techniques of Language Teaching, had become a kind of highway code for all who wanted to make language learning in schools mean something. And here he was, moustache bristling in the sun, declaiming W.B. Yeats's poem Call Down the Hawk from the Air and making Sligo dissolve into the Nile in four lines. Lionel Billows is 83 now. He lives and teaches in Germany, and he writes a lot, poems, jokes, anecdotes, fables. When he was in London recently, I pinned him into a chair in a rather noisy house and made him go back to the beginning.
When I was teaching at the preparatory school for Rossall School in Lancashire, I was only 19 and I hadn't been trained or hadn't even been to the university. So the headmaster said he wanted me to teach Latin to the beginners, French to the second year, mathematics to the third year, and geography to the whole school. But I said, I don't know any geography. I stopped learning geography when I was 13. Doesn't matter, he said, you read the newspapers, I'm sure. I said, well, yes, I do that. So I said to the class, the top class, I said, look, I don't know anything about geography. We must learn it together. So I got hold of some books and we distributed them and each read a book and read bits out of it. And I found a plan for the way the winds blow in the world, and we argued where rain would fall. And I found it was tremendously fascinating learning with these boys. And at the end of the year, the headmaster said, I can't understand it, but we've never had such good passes in geography. I think that was the beginning. I saw that learning together is far more valuable than telling people what to think or what to know.
Socks. Not everyone realizes how important socks can be. People can judge your character by them. Even more important, they may misjudge it. Once one of my superiors concluded that I must be a philanderer because he saw me wearing pink socks. Actually, they had been red, but were old and washed out and were full of holes below where the shoes reached. I think he was wrong in his conclusion, but anyway, he was basing his judgment on incomplete evidence, and if he wished to judge my character on the basis of my socks, he should, I thought, examine the socks more carefully. He might also have gone into the question of whether there might not be reasons for wearing pink socks other than the seduction of women. A friend of mine, a professor of international law, wished to consult some books in the Vatican Library, but his pass had run out or he had left it at home in England. He went to the entrance, hoping to convince whoever was at the door of his credentials, but the two Swiss guards lowered their halberds and were not open to persuasion. So my friend went back to his hotel and changed his socks for a beautiful cherry-coloured pair. This time, when the guards lowered their halberds at his approach, he pulled up his trousers to show his socks. They immediately raised their halberds again, with the greeting appropriate to a cardinal. So much for socks.
Is your model, when you approach a class, the filling up of a tank? Is it the work of a sculptor, moulding? Is it the gardener watering the plants? Or is it two living creatures in contact with one another and reacting on one another? I've never been in favour of trying to persuade children to forget where they come from, or to forget wisdom, if any, of their background, but to help them to carry that further as far as I can guide them. I don't make any claim to superior wisdom, but I do think I've seen the way to find out how to avoid evil, how to encourage people rather than discourage them. A great deal of teaching is chiefly designed to discourage. The giving of marks, for example, is a pretty useless operation. It flatters the ones who need no flattery and discourages the one that ought to have a bit of encouragement. And so that I'm against marks. But I like to help anybody to feel his own potentiality by working with others. I had in Africa a class of boys and girls who I divided into groups, and I got them to write something. Then each group had to pass what it had written to another group. This other group then had to read it out and criticize it. One of the groups said, "Perfect nonsense, badly written and badly expressed." So I said to the group that had written, "What do you say to that?" They said, "Revenge!" So I said, "You see, the result of your criticism has been total rejection." So that recognition is what matters. Recognition of ability, however slight, and helping the person we're facing to realize that we appreciate this, and it's not just empty words.
Turkish Taxis, a short saga. A woman colleague of mine used to be brought to the office every day by the same taxi driver. She didn't speak any Turkish, but if she wanted to make a change in the routine, she would ask him to come into the office, and one of the secretaries or the interpreter would interpret for her. One day he said he wouldn't be able to come for a while, but as she didn't understand, he went with her into the office and explained to the assembled office staff what it was he wanted to tell her. Suddenly the interpreter and the messengers began to shout, and it was some time before she could get them to explain what the trouble was. It seems he was a Laz, that is, he came from the northeast coast around Trebizond, where the people have the reputation for being rather wild. The story he told was as follows. His brother had been murdered, so he, as next of kin, had to go to Trebizond to kill the murderer. And it was at this point in the story that the office staff all started to shout. But he reassured them he wouldn't be in serious danger. He would not do the actual shooting. They would put a pistol in the hand of a 12-year-old boy and wait behind a bush for the murderer to come by. Then they would shoot him quite easily, and the boy, being underage, would not be hanged or have to go to prison. He might simply be sent to a special school. We were all convinced that we had no reason to fear for the safety of our friend the taxi driver. I was leaving Turkey at the time, and it was several years before I saw this woman colleague again. When I did, I asked her what happened to the taxi driver. "Ah," she said, "he wasn't away very long. As soon as the murderer heard that he was coming to Trebizond, he went and gave himself up to the police and asked them to put him in prison. This they did, and he was given 5 or 6 years, so he would be safe from the revenge of the taxi driver, and by the time he came out, the 12-year-old boy would be of age and not willing to hold the pistol. So the taxi driver saw the matter," she said.
I taught a class in India, which was in an out-of-the-way place about 40 miles from the nearest main road, I think it was a long way out. And I saw rows of people around the windows listening in, and I thought, oh, all this wisdom that I'm going to spout, how lovely. But I found the lesson was as dead as anything. And so I said to myself, why is this lesson so horribly dead? And so I spoke to a boy and said, the lesson was supposed to be about professions. You know, the tailor and the tinker and whatnot. I said, what does your father do? Oh, he said, he's a fisherman. Oh, I said, explain to me how he fishes. And he explained the process. I said, do you ever help him? He said, yes, on the weekends I help by folding the nets. Well, this was interesting for everybody. Not everybody had seen what was done, and he described it. So I asked another, Oh, his father was a farmer. I said, well, have you got cows? He says, we got about 4 cows. Well, eventually we started counting the cows possessed by the parents of these boys, and one of them had 120 cows. Suddenly the whole class was alive, caring about what was going on, about what everybody was talking about. And this was, for me, why I needed such a revelation, I don't know. You thought I would have known it long before. But this was a key moment in my life, if you like, where I suddenly found that taking really seriously their life, whatever, not just their opinions, not just what they'd been brought up to believe, but their actual life, what they did, and how they felt for it.
Dishwashing. When we left Heidelberg, my wife was invited to have coffee with our housewife friends to say goodbye in a suitably memorable and significant way. All these well-situated ladies said with one voice, you must get a washing-up machine. This is the one essential household aid to ensure a dignified and suitable way of life for a woman, the only way to avoid being a slave tied to the kitchen sink. When we moved into our new flat, we had to buy a new kitchen sink, and next to it, between it and the window, there was a vacant space. A washing-up machine would fit exactly into the gap, so we decided to buy one. The first we saw cost 2,400 marks, out of the question. Eventually, we found one that cost 500 marks and bought it. The man who delivered it installed it and connected it up. And there it stood, white and shiny. It really filled the gap between the sink and the window. Besides that, it was quite handy for putting things on. But my wife was afraid of getting electrocuted if she touched it, and I thought I could wash up quicker and more thoroughly by hand. So we didn't use it for about 9 months. Then some friends came to stay for a day or two. They were washing-up machine fans. They never stopped telling us how astonished they were and insisting on our using it at once, although we were quite happy to see it there, so white and new-looking. It's quite useful for putting things on, we said. But that didn't satisfy them. They decided to give us a demonstration there and then. I timed the various processes and found that it took 20 minutes to load, or if the plates were very messy, 25 minutes, an hour and a half to run, and 20 minutes to unload and put the crockery away. We had it for about 5 exhausting years. Finally, it lost heart and stopped, never to go again. We put it in the street. I miss it, really.
I was praised a lot by some people at my 80th birthday, but I got very upset at this because I'm not worth anything at all as a person, as an individual. So I said, I'm the glass, I'm not the wine. But I said this again at a conference last year, and a young lady said, you're the well, you're not the glass. I was glad about that. And I quoted, I hope not with too much self-praise, but I was happy about it that she said it with such spontaneous gaiety.